Good evening, everyone. Welcome to Research to Practice. Expert Second Opinion, investigator discuss the optimal management of HER2-positive gastrointestinal cancers. I'm Dr. Lionel Conquer-Fonqua from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. And today I have a wonderful panel of speakers, experts in the field, that will take us through the journey through the GI tract as it relates to HER2-positive cancers. Dr. Hallie Ellis from Mass General Brigham Cancer Institute, Dr. Zev Weinberg from UCLA, Professor Eric Van Cutsem from University of Hoeveel's Hospital Leuven in Belgium, and again, I'm Lionel Conquer-Fonqua from the Mayo Clinic. And these are the faculty disclosures. No commercial, that's the commercial support, and Research to Practice CME planning committee members and staff and reviewers have no relevant conflict of interest to disclose. This educational activity contains discussion of non-FDA approved uses of agents and regimens. Please refer to the official prescribing information for each product for approved indications. All right, so without further ado, this is kind of the outline for today's agenda. So we'll start with the biliary tract cancers session led by Dr. Ellis, followed by gastroesophageal cancers by Dr. Weinberg, and then we'll close with colorectal cancer by Professor Van Cutsem. In preparation for this program and to make sure it's relevant to the participants, we had to survey 50 community-based general medical oncologists in the last month. And a lot of the questions that follow the sessions are drawn from these survey. All right, without further ado, Dr. Ellis, please take it away.
Great, happy to kick off the evening talking about HER2-positive biliary tract cancers. So we'll start with just an overview of the current therapeutic landscape. Chemotherapy and immunotherapy are now the first-line standard in advanced biliary tract cancers. This is the TOPAZ-1 data looking at the combination of gemcitabine cisplatin with durvalumab, and this did improve overall survival, and it's nice to see even with this updated 3-year overall survival data, a doubling of overall survival. Unfortunately, after the progression on first-line therapy, there's much more limited options in the second-line setting. Standard of care chemotherapy has response rates on the order of 5 to 10% with median overall survival of 6 months. So there's really a huge need for better therapies in the second line setting. Biliary tract cancers are unique. Dr. Love refers to biliary tract cancers as the non-small cell lung cancer of GI because there are multiple actionable genomic targets across the anatomic subtypes. So in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, for example, we see an enrichment of targets like FGFR2 fusions and IDH1 mutations, whereas in extrahepatic and gallbladder cancer, we see more HER2 amplification, which will be the focus of today. HER2 amplification overexpression really spans all biliary tract cancer subtypes. We do see higher rates, even up to 35% in gallbladder cancer, with about 10% in extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma and then less than 5% in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. But this definitely represents a targetable alteration in BTC. So moving on to clinical indications, who, when, and how do we test? Really, for BTC in general, we should be testing everyone with unresectable or metastatic disease across all subtypes. The earlier, the better. So doing this at the time of diagnosis is helpful, particularly with more first-line trials available. And then oftentimes, repeating a progression to really assess the status of HER2. There's a number of ways we can look for HER2 amplification overexpression. We have immunohistochemistry, which is looking at HER2 protein overexpression. This is tissue-based testing. This is very fast, cheap, and easy to do. In situ hybridization is looking at the DNA level, at gene amplification, and this is also done in the tissue and is reflex testing, usually for these equivocal IHC cases. And then, of course, we have next-gen sequencing, which the advantage of this is being able to look at multiple genomic alterations, including HER2 amplification, as well as activating mutations. And now with sort of more sensitivity and improving tests, we have this available as blood-based testing as well. There's some nuances and caveats to tissue versus plasma-based NGS. We do not have any defined scoring criteria in BTC specifically. We use the gastric cancer scoring model for HER2. Gastric cancer scoring is different than breast cancer in terms of where we see the expression and how much positivity defines HER2 positivity. But IHC 0-1 plus would be classified as HER2 negative. 2 plus is considered equivocal in reflexes to in situ hybridization. And then IHC 3 plus is HER2 positive. And this is really where a lot of the success has been in this very highly overexpressed setting. This slide is really to highlight the importance of doing both IHC and NGS testing for these biliary tract cancer cases. As we know, across a lot of GI cancers, there's really a lot of heterogeneity. And this is a nice study here with about 300 patients from Korea and MD Anderson showing that just looking at NGS in these cases where we're not detecting any amplification, you can miss up to 15% of patients who have HER2 overexpression and would be eligible for some of these very highly effective therapies. So I think given the fast and cheap nature of being able to do IHC and that it really requires a limited amount of tissue, I think when at all possible, we should be doing both. So this is really just to give you a broad overview of what the second line HER2-targeted landscape looks like in biliary tract cancers. It's incredible to see so many trials that have been done in this space. And we'll focus on some of the data from trastuzumab deruxtecan and zanidatamab specifically. And I actually just wanted to highlight on that prior slide, at the top there, I had ABC06, which is the second line standard of care FOLFOX arm, which has response rates of about 5%, median PFS of 4 months, and median overall survival of 6 months. So just keep that in mind as we talk about some of these HER2-targeted agents. So trastuzumab deruxtecan, many people are familiar with treating lots of different types of cancers. This is a HER2 antibody drug conjugate. This is data from the DESTINY-PanTumor02 trial of T-DXd, looking at locally advanced, unresectable, or metastatic HER2-expressing BTC after progression on at least one line of therapy. HER2 IHC was either 3+ or 2+ by central or local testing. And unique to this trial compared to some of the other trials we'll talk about, there was prior HER2 therapy allowed as part of this study, and about 17% of patients were previously treated with HER2 agents. So here's the efficacy data. In the IHC 3 plus population, you can see a response rate of 56%, median PFS of 7.5 months, and median overall survival of greater than 1 year. And again, just to call back what's even some of the first line and second line data looks like in BTC, this is really a huge advancement. So very exciting. But as you can see, you know, when we look at the IHC 2 plus, we don't see any responses in this study. In terms of safety, again, many people have a good familiarity with T-DXd. This is very chemo-like in its side effects because of the topoisomerase 1 inhibitor payload. So we see things like nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, cytopenias. And of course, something really critical to be mindful of is the ILD and pneumonitis risk. In this study, there was 11% of patients, and actually even 1% were grade 5. Actually, one of these three patients who had a fatal event had BTC. So really important to be very vigilant for ILD. Moving on to the HERB trial, which was a trial in Japan. Again, looking at HER2-expressing BTC, refractory or intolerant to gemcitabine-based therapies. They did allow prior HER2 therapy, though no patients in this 30-patient cohort did receive prior HER2 therapy. And HER2 status was centrally confirmed. Here's the breakdown of the HER2 positive, which was IHC 3 plus or IHC 2 plus-ish positive. And they also looked in the HER2 low setting. So looking at the HER2 positive, again, we see the highest efficacy in the IHC 3 plus setting with response rates of 40%. In the HER2 low setting, there actually was one responder. So probably reflecting, again, this idea of intratumoral and intertumoral heterogeneity of HER2 expression. Again, similar side effects as would be expected with T-DXd, and that we did see 25% pneumonitis in this small series. Moving on to zanidatamab, which is the new kid on the block. This is a HER2 bispecific antibody. So this is unique in that it actually binds two distinct sites on HER2, the same extracellular domain epitopes that trastuzumab and pertuzumab bind to. But this cross-linking that's facilitated by this unique binding really allows this sort of two-in-one drug mechanism with multiple downstream effects, including increased receptor internalization and downregulation of HER2. We see downstream signaling pathway inhibition, as well as immune-mediated cytotoxicity with things like activation of ADCC, ADCP, and CDC. And zanidatamab was recently approved in the previously treated unresectable or metastatic HER2-positive IHC3-plus setting. So the HERIZON-BTC-01 trial of zanidatamab in BTC was looking also in this HER2-positive population, 62 patients with IHC3+. And you can see a response rate of 52% with a median duration of response of 15 months and median overall survival of 18 months, which is really impressive in this second-line setting for BTC. Here's the long-term follow-up. Again, you can see this 18-month median OS in the IHC 3-plus group. There's still some signal of activity in the IHC 2-plus group, so definitely an area that's being actively explored. And this is actually post-hoc analysis that's presented by Dr. Harding here at this meeting, so please look out for his abstract tomorrow, essentially showing that, you know, early responders have better median OS. So in patients that responded by week 9, this landmark analysis shows a median OS of 25 months. The safety of zanidatamab is actually quite a favorable toxicity profile. Mostly we see things like diarrhea and infusion-related reactions. These are usually quite manageable with supportive care for diarrhea like antidiarrheals and hydration. Again, most of this is grade 1 and grade 2, not really requiring drug holds or even dose reduction. And then infusion-related reactions with pre-medication, this tends to be quite manageable as well. And we can often shorten this infusion time down quite significantly. As we see with the class effect of HER2-targeted agents, there is small rates of left ventricular dysfunction, but this resolves in most patients. And then uniquely, though this is a bispecific antibody, we do not see cytokine release syndrome because it's not a T-cell engager. So overall, good safety profile. These are actually two of the phase one trial or phase three first-line trials ongoing right now, looking at T-DXd and zanidatamab in the first-line setting. I think in BTC, it's historically been challenging to enroll these biomarker-driven trials, you know, a rare biomarker in a rare cancer. But I think HER2, we might be able to finally shift the paradigm to bringing these targeted agents into the frontline setting. And here's the takeaways. So happy to discuss some cases now.
Great. Well, thank you for that wonderful review of the status of HER2 targeting and biliary tract cancers. Now we'll go through some cases that came from the community, from the general medical oncologist. The first case here is a 78-year-old lady with HER2-amplified biliary tract cancer that received frontline therapy with chemoimmunotherapy, progressed predominantly in the liver, resulting in some hyperbilirubinemia at 3.7 TBili, not amenable to stenting. So HER2-positive disease progressing on frontline. What would you do here, Dr. Ellis?
Yeah, so not an uncommon situation that we find ourselves in with BTC, with hyperbilirubinemia. I think there are still good options we have available to target HER2, even in the setting of unstentable biliary obstruction. So zanidatamab actually has good safety data. We haven't seen any signal of hepatotoxicity. There's really no issue with from a pharmacokinetics perspective. So I think that's certainly an option to consider with close monitoring. There's also been data looking at FOLFOX and trastuzumab. This was a study done in Korea, looking in the second and third line setting with this combination in HER2-positive disease. Certainly, we give FOLFOX pretty routinely in these cases, and trastuzumab also has good safety and PK data. I would be a little bit hesitant about T-DXd in this setting, primarily because of that irinotecan-like topoisomerase 1 inhibitor payload. Certainly, the mechanism of action of an ADC is unique in that you're having tumor-targeted delivery. You know, there's really rapid clearance from the systemic circulation. So we wouldn't see the same toxicity that we'd see with irinotecan. And in these studies with T-DXd, they did look at bilirubin up to 3 times the upper limit of normal. but 3.7 would just be at the border of that moderate hepatic impairment, so I would certainly use TDXD with caution.
Agreed, and I'm glad you mentioned FOLFOX. Obviously, that's the safest chemotherapy regimen in this setting, and sometimes, depending on the hyperbilirubinemia, you could always start there as a bridge and then introduce the targeted therapy later. The second case, a 72-year-old, maybe Zev can help us here, 72-year-old lady with HER2-positive biliary tract cancer with a reduced ejection fraction of 40%. Role of TDXD versus zanidatamab in such patients? Is cardiac dysfunction a showstopper, a preference of ADC versus bispecific here?
So, I mean, I think the reality with cardiac dysfunction in a lot of these cancers is very different than the sort of the concern in breast cancer, where for the most part, these are long-term patients, and regretfully, right, these patients with metastatic biliary cancer don't usually have more than a one-year survivorship. So I think we have to think about cardiac dysfunction a little differently. Now, of course, you have to use it with caution, but I think maybe I'm wrong here, of course, but I would consider either of these agents in this context to be reasonable. You might want to use dose reductions, of course, but the chronic long-term CHF use that you're likely to see with HER2 inhibition is not going to happen when, unfortunately, the patients aren't going to be on the drug for that long.
No, I totally agree, Zev. I think though there's no published safety data with an EF less than 50%, I agree. I think in this patient population, we would strongly consider using it. I think as long as patients remain asymptomatic from a CHS perspective, it would be reasonable to consider with good monitoring.
I agree. I think these patients have a short window of opportunity, so you don't want to forego potentially a good drug. But monitoring, I think, is the key here. Next, I think we have a 62-year-old gentleman with node-positive gallbladder cancer, HER2-positive, treated in the adjuvant setting with the capecitabine per the BILCAP, and then unfortunately had a recurrence in the liver about a year later. He really wants to be aggressive. Would you give TDXD or zanidatamab in the first line and skip front line? So I know you just went through the data, Dr. Ellis, but is there a scenario where you would forego standard of care frontline chemoimmunotherapy and jump straight to targeted therapy?
So it's certainly very compelling when you see that second line data to want to bring it to the first line. And I think that's why these first line studies are ongoing right now, is to see, you know, when we combine these targeted therapies with chemo and or immunotherapy, you know, do we see that same benefit? You know, per the approval, TDXD and zanidatamab are for previously treated patients. And, you know, capecitabine being 1 year prior, by the trial criteria for all of these first-line studies, as long as he's 6 months out, would be eligible for a first-line study. So certainly I think a first-line study would be the most ideal. And if they did have progression on GemCis, Durva has great second-line options. There's encouraging data from India looking at GemCis plus trastuzumab in 90 patients with HER2-positive BTC. So I think there's a good signal there, and we'll see what these first-line trials show.
Zev, Eric, would you agree? Would you approach this differently?
No, I completely agree. So I would consider this patient as a first-line patient and start and discuss with the patient to start with GemCis, Durva. And although it's an option to go for HER2-targeted treatment, but it would be out of the label in our setting.
Okay. The next one is a 93-year-old elderly female with metastatic gallbladder cancer, HER2-positive. And how would you treat this patient in the front line? Again, kind of similar question, different picture in terms of the patient. Is age just a number here, or would you approach this differently? Maybe Eric?
It's, of course, difficult without seeing the patient, but a 93-year-old patient with an ECOG-2, usually in our setting, it's best supportive care. It's for sure not chemotherapy in this setting. In an in-depth discussion, if the patient really insists, and And HER2-targeted therapy frontline could be an option. The question is, of course, which one? Do we go for trastuzumab alone? Do we go for zanidatamab with a patient like that? Trastuzumab deruxtecan and ECOG-2, 93-year-old patient, that's something I would not do in this setting.
Zev, I see you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it probably offers something. I think, you know, there is a little... Look, 93 ECOG-2 is hard to consider full-dose chemotherapy. I certainly agree with Eric. Probably offer some anti-HER2 targeted therapy, maybe with zanidatamab. We've, you know, safe agent as long as you're conscious of the diarrhea.
Yeah, I think the data is obviously very compelling, and the safety profile, the tolerability of zanidatamab seems terrible. So I guess at least I'll give the patient the benefit of the doubt and maybe give it a try.
I mean, these are sometimes the difference between the United States, where we tend to overtreat patients, right? I mean, that's reality. What Eric is reflecting is a reality.
We discuss more the best supportive care option in this type of patients, but it's an individual decision, of course, with the patient.
All righty. And you have a 70-year-old gentleman with metastatic BTC, status post frontline chemoimmunotherapy, progressing. He has dual two targets, HER2 and FGFR. I assume this is probably an FGFR2 fusion. How do you pick here between anti-HER2 and anti-FGFR? I know the topic here is HER2, but Dr. Ellis, you want to take that one?
Yeah, what a unique case. Certainly seeing concurrent FGFR2 fusions with HER2 positivity would be very rare. I'd love to know how exactly they're defining HER2 positive. If this is IHC3+ in an FGFR2 fusion, it's certainly challenging to think about. Of course, we consider, you know, the toxicity profiles of HER2 agents versus these FGFR inhibitors, which can have a lot of on and off target toxicities. You know, what's the winner in terms of what's really driving the biology is hard to say. I think, you know, HER2 is such a heterogeneously expressed marker in BTC. FGFR2 fusions tend to be a very early driver event and a clonal rearrangement, so it's a little bit more homogenous across tumors. But it's hard to say what is the right sequence. Probably maybe FGFR fusions weigh out a little bit in terms of being the strongest driver, but I think honestly we would try both, and I think the future is combination therapies. There's probably a lot of crosstalk in terms of downstream signaling and resistance.
Yeah, I agree. I think with the data with FGFR2, obviously we have a number of agents approved. We have a number of clinical trials, and I think in my practice, I've actually sequenced patients with 2, 3, 4 FGFR and going on 3, 4 years. So I think this will definitely be a difficult decision, but I'll probably lean towards starting with an FGFR inhibitor in this setting. A different opinion from the panel here, or looks like they agree. Last one here is an 81-year-old gentleman with CKD, metastatic cholangiocarcinoma, has an IDH2, HER2 IHC2+, progressed on frontline chemoimmunotherapy. Would you target HER2 or IDH2 in the second line? Eric, you want to take that one?
The patient, as is indicated here, is HER2 IHC2+, so the indication is you need a positive ISH test, FISH test after that. It would have been IHC3+, then I would go for HER2 targeted therapy, or IHC2+ with a positive FISH test, then I would do also HER2 targeted therapy. But if it's really HER2, IHC2+ FISH negative, and IDH2 mutation, I may go for targeting IDH.
Well, we don't have an approved IDH2 inhibitor, at least in cholangio. So would that change your approach, Dr. Ellis?
Yeah, I think this is a slightly different situation than the last case where I think you have really two strong drivers. HER2 IHC2+, I agree with Eric, is hard in the setting of being ISH negative potentially in IDH2. You know, we don't have any approved agents in cholangio. There's actually a nice abstract being presented here by V. Sahai from Michigan looking at IDH2 cholangio, and did show getting off-label ivosidenib, or not ivosidenib, enasidenib, does have a median PFS of 4 months, getting it in sort of the nth line setting. So certainly I think this is something that we would try and get off-label enasidenib for. The toxicity profile is very good, but IDH is a little bit of a unique biomarker in cholangio, and that it's not this very strong growth-suppressing marker to target.
Great. Thank you. Great cases. I think we will kind of skip here and maybe move to the second module here with Dr. Zev Weinberg on gastroesophageal cancers.
Okay, thank you, Lionel. So I'm going to go over HER2-positive gastric cancer, try to incorporate some of the data you heard today. So I won't belabor the point here, but HER2 biology in gastroesophageal cancer has been around for about 20 years. It's probably 15 to 20% of all comers, primarily in the proximal stomach and GE junction. Here, we also know that there is some degree of association with PD-L1 positivity and that about 90 or 85% of patients with HER2-positive also co-express PD-L1 at least greater than one. Now, just like you heard over here from Haley, I think HER2 IHC is diagnostic at 3+ for being positive. About 90% of those patients are FISH amplified, whereas in 2+, a smaller percentage. So to be considered positive for HER2 and gastroesophageal cancer, you're either 3+ or 2+ FISH positive. Now, keeping in mind that nowadays we're just using a lot of NGS in these patients, and a pretty consistent copy number of greater than 5 is considered to be positive as well. So the top trial is the TOGA trial. That's been around and has been the standard of care for a number of years. That's been around for nearly 15 to 20 years, with an improvement with chemotherapy trastuzumab over chemotherapy alone. There have been then a bunch of failures with lapatinib and pertuzumab. Now, the KEYNOTE-811 study was the standard of care, and maybe still is. That'll be subject for discussion. This is a trial that randomized patients to chemotherapy trastuzumab versus chemotherapy trastuzumab pembrolizumab. And the study, of course, met its endpoint for overall survival, particularly in the group of patients who are CPS greater than 1. Such that the FDA approved this therapy a couple years ago based on the overall survival advantage improving from about 16.8 months to 20 months. Again, the PD-L1 subgroup did not show in the final analysis a significant improvement in overall survival in this study, and therefore the restriction was in PD-L1 positive, HER2 positive disease. Now, zanidatinib, you've just heard about it. In gastric cancer, it actually does have single agent activity, which distinguishes it. Just like in biliary tract cancer, trastuzumab has no single agent activity. In gastric cancer, trastuzumab has no single agent activity, and zanidatinib does. It's a bispecific antibody binding both the pertuzumab domain that we talked about and the trastuzumab domain. And here it became clear, just as you've heard from Haley, that the drug does have GI toxicity. So they launched this study, which was just presented this morning by Elena Lomova, the Horizon GA1 study. Now, the study was launched prior to the FDA's requirement that a control arm contain PD-1 inhibitor. So that's why the arm A was still in existence. But because of that, the study was not able to open in the United States because at around the same time, the KEYNOTE-811 regimen was approved. So therefore, the study you heard about today had no patients from the U.S. and was really enrolled in Asia and Europe and other countries. Study enrollment was basically the same as all standard HER2-positive studies, 3+ or 2+ by IHC. There were three arms, as you could see here, randomized 1:1:1. At top is the control arm. The second arm is zanidatinib plus chemotherapy without PD-1 inhibitor. And the bottom arm, arm C, then that zanidatinib plus tisle plus chemotherapy. Primary endpoint actually is PFS, using independent central review with OS as a co-primary. Now, this was a large study, 914 patients. You can actually do this in Asia pretty quickly, as you'll start to see as we see more and more studies being done in Asia. We see we're able to enroll these studies pretty quickly. Study was well-designed with over 2 years follow-up median time in all arms. So the first primary endpoint they presented was the PFS endpoint. This showed an improvement of median PFS from 8.1 months, which is about what we'd expect with trastuzumab chemotherapy. It's actually better than the historical control, versus 12.4 months median PFS with zanidatinib. So I think the first point here is zanidatinib is a better HER2 blocker than trastuzumab, and this is pretty clear here that the median PFS was improved with a hazard ratio of 0.65. The second endpoint shows that the three drugs, zanidatinib plus tislelizumab plus chemotherapy, also had a very similar median PFS, if you remember, 12 and change here. Same hazard ratio, 0.63. Now, when you look at overall survival, this was the first data set they showed. Didn't quite hit, this was an interim analysis of OS, didn't quite hit the statistical significance, the hazard ratio is 0.8, and it's hugging the confidence interval of 1.01, very likely will be positive probably in the next analysis, which is going to be in the next 6 months or so. Here you have a 24.4-month median overall survival versus 19.2 months with trastuzumab plus chemotherapy. And in the three drugs, you see 26.4 months median overall survival versus 19.2. That did meet statistical significance. So what you have here, what we're missing, of course, is how did the three drugs compare to the two drugs, which has not been formally analyzed statistically, but will be. So the question is, are there patients who do better? Are there patients who should get three drugs, two drugs? When I say three drugs, I mean FOLFOX or CAPOX, by the way, very important point. All patients got CAPOX, not FOLFOX. FOLFOX is what Americans tend to use for gastroesophageal cancer, primarily because most of our tumors are GE junction and patients can't swallow pills so easily. But in Asia, there is a lot more CAPOX use. So here you could see, if you kind of see on the bottom there, I'm trying to point, but I can't. Oh, I'm actually going backwards, but I really meant to point. Anyways, the OS and key pre-specified endpoints was a bit confusing here. You can kind of see on the bottom that the TAP less than one, they use TAP instead of CPS, which is more or less seems to be the same. They seem to have got better benefit with the addition of tislelizumab, which is somewhat counterintuitive, whereas the TAP greater than one seems to, the median crosses one. So this is the first counterintuitive thing, I think, that we have to ask ourselves about this data set. Second thing you can see is the IHC 2 plus ISH positive also hugged the median, but admittedly, that is very small numbers. Big point about toxicity, I think Haley made it earlier, but this drug does have significant GI toxicity because it binds the secondary domain of HER2, which is known to be the reason for the GI toxicity. So all medications, all patients had mandatory pre-medication with 4 milligrams BID of loperamide. And that's because the drug for the first 2 weeks causes its highest risk of diarrhea. So for the first week or two, every patient had mandatory requirements, and that was amended based on the phase 2 study. Despite that, you can kind of see on the far left that zanidatamab plus tislelizumab plus chemotherapy had about 80% of patients with diarrhea. I mean, that's not even grade 1, 2 diarrhea, is a lot of GI toxicity. So when this drug becomes available, and I hope it does for these patients, you know, we have to keep in mind the aggressive importance of premedicating with all sorts of antidiarrheals. That's especially important because they use CAPOX, which also already causes more diarrhea by and large than FOLFOX. So in second line, I won't belabor the point too much, but the whole thing gets all mixed up because of constant selective pressure of an anti-HER2 agent for the better part of a year. We know that about 30 or 40% of patients, if you biopsy them or even via ctDNA, have no longer dominant HER2 expression. So what to do with these patients has been somewhat controversial. And this has been shown in a number of preclinical papers over the years, and even in this TIAC study done out of Japan, was very clear. That's why Taxol plus or minus trastuzumab was a negative study, because so many patients, turns out, had lost HER2 expression by the time they made it to second line. Now, you got around that a little bit with the T-DXd, because T-DXd, of course, introduces a novel drug into the equation and also has the bystander effect, and also patients who are irinotecan naive. So now they have a exatecan payload, which they hadn't seen. And there were two studies done, the DESTINY-Gastric01 and DESTINY-Gastric02, which both, you know, the DESTINY-Gastric01 was a randomized phase 2 study compared to chemotherapy, and that ultimately led to the approval. Now, one of the things we know is ctDNA can actually do a pretty good job of telling you if your patient's still HER2 amplified. And in that study, the best patients who did the best, the highest response rate of 60%, were those patients in second and third line who were amplified with a high copy number. So that's just, I, as practice, do at the very least ctDNA on every patient who's progressed on anti-HER2 therapy. Sometimes I'll biopsy them if I really have good reason to, but at the very least, circulating DNA, check for copy number. So the DESTINY-Gastric04 puts the hypothesis that it's actually better than the standard of care. Now, RAMPAC is the standard of care for all gastric cancer, or I should say was, even HER2-positive and HER2-negative, and this study was reported in New England Journal of Medicine last year. Here you could see the study met its endpoint, 4 overall survival improvement, median OS from 11 months to 14.7 months. This is a prognostically good category. The HER2 negatives don't do as well, of course. And it met its endpoint statistically significant, and that reaffirmed the FDA's decision to indeed approve trastuzumab deruxtecan for second-line metastatic gastric cancer. Now, what is the right dose? Dr. Ben Cutson will talk about dosing and the CRC question. It compared two doses, 5.4 and 6.4. We know 6.4 milligrams per kilogram is not an easy dose for a lot of people. We know it causes not insignificant numbers of ILD and other chemotherapy toxicities. And that CRC study that he'll talk about, maybe 5.4 is good enough. I tend to think that the same rules may apply in this disease as well, even though the label is 6.4. So, again, HER2, we should retest it just to make sure patients are really HER2 positive, and if they are in second line, we should offer them a TDXD. Now, what about HER2 low? HER2 low is a big deal in breast cancer. I'm told almost every breast cancer patient is eligible these days for TDXD. Gastric cancer, we don't see that. There is no evidence yet that HER2 low or even HER2 so-called intermediate, the IHC2 plus and FISH negative patients, the response rate may be there, but these are very uncontrolled experiments and we shouldn't be using the drug, in my opinion, unless the patients are truly HER2 positive. Finally, what's the next step with TDXD? So TDXD went through a very complicated combination frontline study in which TDXD was combined with a number of different agents over many years. This was a staggered phase 1 dose expansion exploration study. First, they added 5-FUK, then they added 5-FUK Pembro, then they added Pembro alone, then they changed the dose of TDXD, and then they added Capox. And so it went through various iterations over the years. Ultimately, the goal was to reach the safe and efficacious combination with which to do the phase 3 study, because obviously they want to move the drug to front line. Now, this is a complicated waterfall plot and doesn't really teach us anything other than virtually the response rates are very similar across the board. So it came down to a safety decision, meaning the waterfall plots in these small cohorts don't really tell you, oh gosh, which is the best combination with TDXD. So ultimately it came down to a safety decision. And the dose that was selected, I'll go to the next slide, was on the top, you could see TDXD at 5.4 milligrams per kilogram with 5-FU or capecitabine and pembrolizumab. That's in the main cohort. And the Explore Z cohort without the PD-1 inhibitor with CPS less than 1 does not have the PD-1 inhibitor. That's the DESTINY-Gastric05 study that's currently enrolling. Now, I will say that that study may be changed now in light of the whole PD-L1 question. So I'm going to go back. There's also this study, which is another randomized phase 3 study called the ARTEMIDE-Gastric01 study, also looking at TDXD combinations. Here they're looking at TDXD and 5-FU with a bispecific PD-1 TIGIT antibody. So again, two different frontline HER2 positive studies that are enrolling globally. And then there are other companies as well. This is obviously a ripe area for drug development. HER2 positive gastric cancer behaves much better and has obviously all sorts of actionable areas to target, both frontline and second line. So today's presentation, I think, with zanidatamab did leave us with some confidence, first of all, that, in my opinion, if it gets approved, that should be at least the standard of care with Capox plus zanidatamab and HER2-positive gastric cancer. However, I still think, personally, the question of contribution of components is not yet answered. I'm looking forward to seeing the comparison of the tislelizumab 3-drug combination versus chemotherapy plus zanidatamab alone.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Weinberg, for that wonderful review of what appears to be a rapidly evolving landscape in gastroesophageal cancers. Before we move on to the case, I think we got some questions from the audience that I would like to address, and maybe we'll go back to the prior slide, if you can, because the slide on the ARTEMIDE, there was a question that came from the audience asking about perspectives on rilvostigmig potential in biliary tract cancers and gastric cancer, given the TIGIT data to date. So we know TIGIT has been a target. It's an exhaustion marker. We know some of the data in HCC, lung cancer, that hasn't been the greatest. So questions about the potential of TIGIT in biliary tract cancer and gastric cancer. Maybe we'll start with Dr. Ellis, and then we'll go to Dr. Weinberg.
So the Artemide study in BTC is an adjuvant study looking at the combination of Rilva with chemo. That recently just finished enrolling. So I think we will eagerly await the data for that. I think our standard of care has been capecitabine for many years now. So we'll see if there's a signal from adding PD-1 TIGIT targeting in the adjuvant space.
Here, in that context, all they need to do is be a capecitabine in the adjuvant. And here what you have to show is your TIGIT combination is going to be better than the existing standard of care, which you already saw today has a 2-year overall survival. So personally, you know, having been involved with TIGIT drugs, I think it's a big challenge. And we've had a bunch of negative failures in TIGIT now, most recently in gastric cancer with the STAR-221 study. But, you know, you have to ask yourself, okay, is this going to be a fruitful exercise? You have to achieve pretty much a median overall survival of close to 2.5 years, probably, to show a statistically significant benefit. So it will be a tough challenge, in my opinion.
Yeah, indeed, the TIGIT antibodies, most of the studies or all the studies that were reported were negative, but this is different. This is bispecific antibody, so we still should look at the data. Of course, we don't know, and everybody is now very, very cautious with the negative studies, and we saw also some recent press release of another study that was negative with the TIGIT antibody in gastric cancer. So it's going to be difficult, but this is a bispecific antibody.
Correct. And I think there was a phase 2 trial, I think, that was done in biliary tract cancers, chemo with the PD-L1 TIGIT inhibition. That was positive, but I'm not sure it was a bispecific. So more to come on the TIGIT. Thank you. The other question that was before we move on to gastroesophageal cancers, Dr. Ellis, there were a couple of follow-up questions. How do you approach second and third line for biliary tract cancers without a target?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think in the biomarker agnostic space, it's kind of wide open at the moment. We've certainly seen, you know, a number of studies looking at 5-FU-based therapies, FOLFOX, FOLFIRI, NALIRI, with pretty equivalent outcomes across the board. I think there's a huge interest in trying to develop novel agents in that space. The CTX-009 study, which is a VEGF DLL4 bispecific. You know, we'll see what the survival data looks like from that, but the response rate was 17% versus about 5%. Again, the bar is perhaps a bit lower in BTC than it is in gastric cancer because our standard of care is just insufficient at this point.
Agreed. And an area of unmet need and definitely where we need to enroll more patients in clinical trials. Last, before I move on, there was a question about a patient with osteoarthritis and metastatic intrahepatic cholangio, HER2 3+, progressing on chemoimmunotherapy. What HER2-directed therapy would you use in the second line? Trastuzumab, pertuzumab, trastuzumab, tucatinib, TDXD, or zanidatamab?
I mean, it's great to have a wealth of options that are now in the NCCN guidelines. I think certainly there's patient-shared decision-making that comes into that. A lot of patients, after they've had frontline chemoimmunotherapy with gemcitabine-based chemo, are pretty fatigued from chemo. So I think something like zanidatamab can be very attractive because it's sort of chemo-free in a sense. And the efficacy of TDXD and zanidatamab is excellent in the second-line setting. So it's great to have multiple options. But I think definitely, as we discussed, non-biomarker-driven options are insufficient. So if you have HER2, I would definitely target it.
And the duration of response was also very impressive. Is that in
15 months, yes.
I don't know if Eric or Seth have additional comments.
Yeah, I think the data are clearly there. We have two options. That's zanidatamab and trastuzumab deruxtecan in this situation. And in the future, we will learn what is the best option in this setting. But both are options, clearly. And we will sequence them probably in many patients.
Okay, thank you. So we'll move on to the cases for gastroesophageal cancer. So the first case, 69-year-old gentleman with stage 2. Disease treated with a cross regimen, had local recurrence 15 months after that, after a resection. PD-L1 positive, CPS-10, HER2 positive. Local recurrence treated with FOLFOX, trastuzumab, pembrolizumab. And then he unfortunately developed an isolated brain met, which was resected. Would you give adjuvant T-DXd for how long? So
yes, it's a good question. I mean, I think that, first of all, this is not an infrequent situation. HER2-positive gastric cancer does have a predilection to go to the CNS. So we do see, especially because of better outcomes, we see some patients living, going into some sort of remission and then recurring with brain metastases. Now, if it's isolated, fully resected, and adjuvantly treated with adjuvant radiation, I would not do further therapy. I would watch this patient and not necessarily do T-DXd or anything else for that matter. I would just watch this patient off therapy.
And these cases do happen. You know, what's the CNS penetration of T-DXd compared to something like tucatinib, extrapolating from the data from breast cancer?
Well, you know, ADCs, I don't think we really know fully how well these drugs do penetrate the CNS. You're right, tucatinib is a TKI that does have brain metastasis. I've actually used it in HER2-positive gastric cancer, even though it's not approved and is off-label. But I think we don't really know what the degree of penetration with T-DXd is, certainly in gastric cancer.
Great. 58-year-old gentleman with HER2-positive G-junction cancer, treated with FOLFOX, trastuzumab, nivolumab, progress with lymph nodes in the lymph nodes and brain mets. Now, in second-line treatment with T-DXd, is there a role for zanidatamab third-line?
I don't think so. This strikes me as one of these patients who may not even be HER2-positive anymore, but obviously they'd have to take a look at that. I would prefer usually in these patients actually ever two lines of anti-HER2 therapy, doing a cytotoxic chemotherapy, especially with brain metastasis. I would think about paclitaxel ramucirumab or even paclitaxel taxane by itself that does have CNS penetration.
And you did bring up the idea of rebiopsying. Obviously, you described the heterogeneity, both spatial and temporal. Eric, is that something you do routinely? Or?
Yeah, we try to recommend to do routine biopsies in the DESTINY studies, the DESTINY, at least the Gastric 02, DESTINY Gastric 04 study. This was mandatory. The label doesn't say that you have to do it. So we try to have a pragmatic attitude. If possible, if easily, if you can take an easy biopsy, then I would do it. If, of course, taking biopsies is very risky, then I would not do it. The reality is that patients may lose HER2 expression after a prior treatment, and we don't know what's going to happen now. If zanidatamab is going to be in first line, there are some suggestions that many of the patients, or most of the patients, even may have lost their HER2 expression when they progress on zanidatamab. So in this situation, a biopsy would be for sure needed.
And since we're on the topic of heterogeneity, we know that there's a discordance between IHC and NGS. And, you know, so at baseline, what platform do you use? Do you use IHC, NGS, liquid, all three to kind of capture the whole picture?
I mean, at baseline, you know, IHC testing is pretty standard, and you get a rapid turnaround in a day. So you pretty much know a few days. You know if patients HER2 positive from the get-go. I think later on, after progression, you know, if it's not, like Eric said, if it's difficult to biopsy, I actually find ctDNA to be pretty reliable for HER2. Copy numbers, you know, if those patients are really still HER2 positive, you're going to pick it up on a ctDNA study, particularly in gastric cancer.
Great. All right, we'll go on to the next case here. 56-year-old gentleman with stage 4 G junction cancer to the liver. CPS1, HER2-3+, progress on chemo-targeted therapy and immunotherapy. You're planning to give T-DXd in the second line. Unfortunately, repeat biopsy shows IHC2+, FISH negative, NGS is positive for HER2 activating mutation. So what do you do here? Do you go with T-DXd, knowing the data, and what's the data for activating mutations versus, you know, amplification or overexpression?
So in gastric cancer, activating mutations are not that common, but, you know, sometimes it happens. There's not great data, actually, with T-DXd in this context, to my knowledge. I don't know if I would actually treat this patient with T-DXd at all. I think this is also somebody who I might say, hey, this isn't HER2 positive anymore. This is HER2 mutated. That's a different thing. And personally, I'd probably treat this patient with paclitaxel ramucirumab.
Great. A 53-year-old gentleman, HER2 cause amplified G-junction cancer, PD-L1 positive, progressed on frontline chemo, immunotherapy, targeted therapy. Before considering second-line options, how important is this to rebiopsy? I think we've talked about that. Is there any role in HER2-targeted therapy in 1-plus versus 2-plus? Again, I think we covered that pretty well. But mechanistically, zanidatamab, T-DXd, what are your thoughts?
So zanidatamab, I don't think, you know, here has been studied well at all in this 1-plus, 2-plus setting. You have very little data. You saw it from Japan in the 2-plus-ish negative patients showing, you know, maybe 20% response rate, but out of 30, 40 patients, I mean, again, I think these are the kind of patients that are probably not necessarily that strongly HER2 positive anymore. And, you know, that represents 30 to 40% of patients. It's really a unique situation. And I don't know if anti-HER2 therapy should be considered necessarily in patients that are no longer HER2 positive.
All right, so 73-year-old female, dysphagia endoscopy found to have an semi-obstructive mass in the G-junction, HER2 positive, no metastasis. Would you use HER2, or what neoadjuvant approach would you recommend? I guess the question is there a role for HER2 targeting in the neoadjuvant setting?
Yeah, I mean, this is a good question and a real practical question. I think when it's 3+, you know, you really are tempted. HER2 2+ fish, I mean, you just saw today in the zanidatamab data, they don't do as well with anti-HER2 therapies. The benefit clearly isn't there. Now, I will say there's a study, the FERFLOT study, that looked at FLOT, which is the standard of care in this patient, assuming that this patient is being treated with surgical intent, FLOT plus durvalumab. We don't know how many patients were enrolled with on Matterhorn with HER2 positive, but some probably were. It's something they're going to look at. There is a study called the FERFLOT, I was referring to that earlier, that was FLOT, pembrolizumab, trastuzumab, and had a very high pathological response rate, upwards of 40 or 50%. Now, single arm phase 2 study, I think the randomized study is ongoing at this time, but, you know, I must confess, I have used that regimen in HER2 3+ patients because I feel that pathological, very high response rate was very compelling. I don't know, Eric, it's a European study, so yeah, he probably knows more about it.
I'm not involved in the study. It's a German study. I completely agree. But they reported also several patients who died on the study. So we have to be careful before giving a general recommendation. But it's tempting. In a patient like that, I would like to see also the CT scan to see whether the patient is resectable, whether it's a tumor that's growing intraluminally or extraluminally, whether it's locally advanced disease. Then you have a more, let's say, if it's unresectable, then you would go more even for a HER2 targeted therapy in this setting.
And I would like to see, and I'm pretty sure, maybe Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, I'm pretty sure Matterhorn did not look at HER2. So I don't know if it was an exclusion criteria there. Maybe you could correct me. But I think I would be interested in the end. That's something that they're going to look at when they look at all the tissue. Were some of the patients on their HER2, and what was the benefit of the checkpoint inhibitor in that patient population? It'll be interesting.
Agreed. So I think we have a couple of questions from the audience. I think the first one, 40-year-old metastatic gastric cancer, PD-L1 5%, HER2 positive, FOLFOX, trastuzumab, pembro in the front line, second line T-DXd, now progressing, good performance status. Role for zanidatamab after progression, I think we can.
Yeah, I mean, look, single agent activity. I don't know if we're going to get zanidatamab for that patient. Remember, it's not approved for, it's approved for biliary tract, not really approved for gastric cancer at all. If the patient has good performance status, and, you know, you can somehow magically get that drug paid for, that seems reasonable to me. And someone who's still HER2-driven and you know the drug has single-agent activity. In this country, I think we do tend to petition insurance providers for those kind of off-label use on occasion.
Right. So I know there was asked about activating mutations earlier. I think there's a question about agents like zongertinib that are used in HER2-mutant non-small cell lung cancer. Is there a potential role here in patients with activating mutations?
Yes, so it depends. First of all, I think it depends on where the point mutation is, right? Because zongertinib looks like a fantastic HER2 TKI in lung cancer. I mean, And, you know, but that may not have the same point mutation as this patient with gastric cancer. I did see in their phase one study, they did have some responders with gastric cancer. So I think it's feasible to again, something to consider, assuming that those point mutations are of the same type that the lung cancer patients got.
Great. And maybe the second online and last online question here, maybe Dr. Ellis, you could take this one. 64-year-old metastatic gastric cancer, HER2 positive, CPS-10, coronary artery disease, hypertension, frontline, chemo, immunotherapy, trastuzumab, partial response, progress after 9 months, and then second-line T-DXd with marked response, complicated by grade 1 ILD, and requiring dose interruption. So now the patient, what patient or disease factors should guide choice of T-DXd versus a non-ADC HER2 therapy, particularly regarding the ILD risk and the performance status?
Yeah, so I think ILD is a real toxicity that we have to monitor very closely for and certainly have a very low threshold for interrupting therapy. I think sort of this is probably a good opportunity when you have toxicity to reassess HER2 status, make sure they're still truly positive either by tissue or by liquid NGS. I really like Zev's idea for looking at copy number. But I would be hesitant about rechallenging with T-DXd unless... because we do have other non-HER2 targeting options if needed.
What if I twist that a little bit and say the patient had resolved pneumonitis, so had a history of pneumonitis? Eric, I see you smiling. How would you approach that?
Yeah, if the patient had a history, there is, and it was completely resolved, and if it was only a grade 1, right, as you said, then there is no contraindication, then you can do it. Depends on the different options. If you would have different options, you could also go for another option. But nothing is wrong if you have only that option to restart again in this patient, if it was completely resolved.
And a 56-year-old metastatic GE junction cancer progressed on FLUT plus nivolumab, new liver lesion, HER2-positive CPS greater than 1. Should I consider 5-FU-oxaliplatin trastuzumab pembro? Is durvalumab better? What about T-DXd for this patient? Is there any
time? Yeah, so it's a good question. And you know, how long after the FLUT the patient progressed, right, is one of the important variables. Someone progressed within 3 months of FLOT, I don't think it makes a lot of sense to put them on FOLFOX. So I think definitely anti-HER2 therapy has to be part of the equation. And whether it's T-DXd or whether you want to use, off-label FOLFIRI with trastuzumab that a lot of people have experience with, I think either of those are reasonable. I would definitely have that patient get follow-up over time whether they still retain HER2 positivity. That might be a patient for, you know, the zanidatinib ultimately, because that patient hasn't had yet an anti-HER2 and they have had a checkpoint inhibitor.
Great. So before we move on, maybe a question for anyone on the panel. So with the data presented today with the zanidatinib data, obviously potentially practice changing, in the front line, should that regimen get approved? We shouldn't do cross-track comparisons, but you know, which regimen would you use? The KEYNOTE-811? Does the Horizon have an edge?
So number one, we have to see, I think, again, what arm C did compared to arm B, and we'll probably have the answer to that before the FDA actually approves this regimen. Now, I do think, based on the data presented today, personally, I think zanidatinib is a far superior anti-HER2 agent, and we should probably be considering that as the base. Now, the question that comes up, which is pretty challenging, is that our new standard of care? Is our new standard of care, or do we continue with FOLFOX, trastuzumab, pembro? Because, after all, that wasn't the control arm in this study. So I think I think I'd be comfortable with both of those personally. I think at the end, it's going to be immunotherapy will probably be continued in this patient population, probably with tislelizumab, because we all gravitate towards immunotherapy naturally. So I think at the end of the day, when all the dust settles, that's probably where we'll be. And we'll have to see what the FDA looks at it. It's not going to be so easy. There are a lot of unanswered questions still in the data set. So I'm going to be really curious to see how the FDA looks at all this data. I think they did meet their primary endpoint pretty convincingly, though.
And they seem to be benefiting both PD-L, regardless of PD-L1 status. So.
Yeah, which is, again, counterintuitive and changes, what we saw with KEYNOTE-811.
Great. Thank you so much for that. We'll move on, last but not least, to colorectal cancer with Professor Venkata. Please take it away.
Thank you very much. So on the data in colorectal cancer, first a couple of data on what guidelines tell us and also on the testing. So unlike breast and gastric cancer, HER2 positivity in colorectal cancer lacks a standardized definition. However, we often use the so-called Heracles criteria from the initial data with lapatinib and trastuzumab in this setting, looking at HER2 positivity defined, as you can see there, with immunochemistry and then ISH testing in this setting. Another challenge is the intratumoral heterogeneity, which is there in gastric cancer also, which is there also in colorectal cancer. In the end, we can use different approaches. We can use for IHC, go for IHC and then do a FISH test. Or there are more and more arguments to go for gene-based approaches on the NGS, on the tumor, or circulating DNA, as we discussed already, liquid biopsies in this setting as further recommendation for the future. We've seen many different studies looking at the incidence and at the frequency in this situation of HER2 in colorectal cancer. Around 5% of the left-sided colon cancers were HER2 amplified or HER2 positive. And we have seen that HER2 amplification was enriched also in RAS, BRAF, PI3 kinase, wild-type tumors and left-sided tumors, as I said already. And in general, we can remember that around 3% of all colorectal cancers are HER2 positive. 5% of the RAS, BRAF, wild-type colorectal cancers, an enrichment in left-sided and rectal cancers, and also, as was said already earlier, in association with CNS metastasis. HER2 mutations do occur in colorectal cancer. They are even less frequent. 1 to 2% of the colorectal cancers are HER2 mutant. And there have been many different studies on the prognostic impact of HER2 amplification. Some of these data were controversial. However, recently we saw a very nice publication, a combined analysis in more than 1,600 patients coming from 8 different trials, showing a negative prognostic significance of HER2 positivity, HER2 defined with IHC or FISH test, so amplification. And here this is maybe small, but these are the figures from the GCO, looking in HER2 mutant patients, also a negative prognostic factor for patients which were HER2 positive, and no differential outcome in these studies for bevacizumab or anti-EGFR therapy. So that's what we know in this setting. Let's then go to the treatments. You've already heard about the different options, different types of drugs going from single epitopes, antibodies, ADCs, bispecific antibodies, and TKIs in this setting. And just looking at a bunch of different trials, these trials are all phase 2 trials. We don't have any phase 3 trials yet in colorectal cancer. There's one ongoing at least. The first trial was with lapatinib, trastuzumab, the Heracles trial. And in this study, with trastuzumab, lapatinib, around 30% of the patients, around 30% of the patients had an objective response, pre-treated patients in this setting. Later, we saw different other trials, all showing consistent in non-randomized studies, consistent high response rates in pre-treated HER2-positive patients, usually defined as IHC 3+ or 2+, followed by a positive FISH test. The data of the MOUNTAINEER study are relevant to discuss. That's with tucatinib, trastuzumab, in this setting, there was first cohort A to tucatinib trastuzumab, and then later on there was a randomization between tucatinib trastuzumab versus tucatinib alone in this study. And as you can see, this is the waterfall plots for the patients treated with tucatinib trastuzumab, which was the most active regimen in this study. You can see nice waterfall plots, quite high response rate in this study of around 40% of patients had an objective response in the study, 38% to be precise. High response rate in the IHC 3 plus compared to the other patients, but also some activity in the other patients. So the 2 plus followed by a positive FISH test in this setting. The progression-free survival, and again, it's non-randomized data sets of 8 months. Overall survival in this pretreated population, HER2 positive with tucatinib trastuzumab, of around 2 years, 23.9 months in this setting. and also looking at the different testing methods, an important message also for clinical practice. You can look at tissue, IHC, FISH, tissue NGS or blood NGS. And looking, if you look at the response rate with these different criteria determining to positive patients, response rates were similar in these different subgroups with different testing methods and also long duration of responses as is shown here. The adverse event profile of tucatinib trastuzumab, most common related toxicity is GI, mainly diarrhea with tucatinib. Fatigue and nausea may also occur in some of these patients, but that's something practicing clinicians should be aware and should be able to manage diarrhea, as we've seen also with other HER2 targeted agents such as anitatamab, as was discussed earlier. And there's now a study ongoing. It's not easy to recruit patients in first line. It's a randomized phase 3 study, first line, HER2 positive with the criteria that I mentioned, standard of treatment, and then a combination of FOLFOX, trastuzumab, tucatinib in the experimental arm with the primary endpoint progression-free survival. I cannot show you results. The study is still recruiting right now today. Switching then to the other agent, trastuzumab deruxtecan, the antibody drug conjugate. The first study in colorectal cancer was done was the Destiny CRC01 study, different cohorts. Cohort C was IHC 1 plus, cohort B was IHC 2 plus and a negative ish test. And then cohort A is the classic HER2 positive cohort, IHC 3 plus or 2 plus followed by a positive FISH test. This is non-randomized study. A primary endpoint is overall response rate. And again, here in this study, for patients with a classic HER2 positive tumor, a very high response rate, 45% pretreated patients, no clear relevant activity in the other group of patients in B and C, a very low number of patients, but as you can see, no objective responses were reported by our Japanese colleagues in this study. They looked also at analysis according to IHC criteria 3 plus and 2 plus. The message here on this slide also is that response duration was long. You can see that on the spaghetti plots left bottom of the slide. And also a decent and a nice impact on survival in this study. After this study, there was a Destiny CRC-02 study done, and that's a study, Sev already alluded to that, looking at the doses, that those here in the study, there were in stage one, there was a group of patients treated with a dose of 5.4 milligrams per kilogram, and arm two was 6.4 milligrams per kilogram. And then later in stage two, there was an expansion at the lower dose at 5.4, which is the dose that is often used in many other cancers, not in gastric cancer. There, the doses were 6.4 in the different studies. So that's the design of the Destiny CRC study. There was clear activity. Response rate was higher in the lower dose, probably showing that there was a bit more toxicity with a higher dose and that patients could not be continued with the treatment in this setting. So that's the bottom line message. So that the preferred dosing is the lower dose, 5.4 milligrams per kilogram every 3 weeks in this setting. And also, that's a complex slide with a lot of information, and you may not be able to see, but it was looking at also the different data and different molecular analysis in these patients, showing that trastuzumab deruxtecan, this antibody drug conjugate, patients with a RAS mutant tumor, although they are rare, they could be included, and there was some activity across the different mutations. This was not the case with tucatinib data. There only patients with a wild-type, RAS wild-type tumor could be included in this study. Adverse event profile is similar to what we see in the other diseases. Around 10% of the patients have interstitial lung disease or pneumonitis, so we should be aware. We discussed already, and there was an indication for that earlier on in the debate. Finally, some data on zanidatamab. Very early data. You've heard that biliary tract cancer, stomach cancer, also in colorectal cancer. The number of patients that have been treated is very small, but you can see the waterfall plots. This is a all-comers study, but there are some colorectal cancer patients. There was clearly some activity in this, and that's also the basis for now a study project and ongoing plans of zanidatamab plus chemotherapy for HER2-positive patients. This is dose-finding study with FOLFOX, zanidatamab, or zanidatamab, FOLFOX, bevacizumab. This regimen seems to be feasible. There is clearly some activity. You can see the waterfall plots on the left bottom. Again, low number of patients, but it's clear that will may proceed also in the future. It's not yet mature to be recommended for clinical practice in this situation. So there's a lot of activity ongoing in the different GI cancers. Question is, how can we even further progress? I had the privilege to be the co-PI of the TOGA study more than 15 years ago. I'm happy that we see that there are now many new treatment options that are coming in this setting, going for new TKIs. For instance, one of them, zorgitinib, was mentioned just a moment ago, going from different classes of agents in this setting, as is illustrated on this slide. And I don't want you to read this, but this is a table that I took from a recent manuscript, a very recent manuscript, where you can see different anti-HER2 therapies under investigation in this setting. And you can see, I do that on purpose, show that so that to give the message that there is a lot of activity ongoing for those who want to read and to go in detail. The references are there. You have the slides there in this setting. So to end and to as a conclusion, in colorectal cancer, although the HER2-positive patients is a small group, 3% in the enriched, 3% in all comers, 5% in the enriched left-sided RAS wild-type patients, it's an important group. We have treatment options. Tucatinib trastuzumab works well in RAS wild-type patients. Trastuzumab deruxtecan works also regardless of the RAS status and regardless of prior anti-HER2 therapy in this setting. And there are more studies ongoing with earlier lines with tucatinib, studies with zanidatamab, and there is a long list of other TKIs and other drugs that is under investigation right now.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Venkatesan, for helping us digest all of that data from colorectal cancer. Before we move on to the cases for colorectal cancer, I'm going to go back to gastroesophageal for a little bit. We had a couple of online questions that should be quick ones, maybe for Zev. Assuming zanidatamab gets approved, in what patients are you using it, with or without tislelizumab?
I think ultimately it probably will be utilized with tislelizumab, and you know, you do have a compelling median overall survival advantage, at least compared to the control arm. Again, I'm looking forward to seeing the C versus B comparison, but on the basis of what we saw today, I'd certainly be comfortable with that regimen.
Another quick one, I think we kind of covered that a little bit. For a 7-year-old patient with fatty liver disease diagnosed with stage 4 gastroesophageal cancer, IHC 2 plus for HER2, PD-L1 10%, progresses on frontline FOLFOX and nivolumab. Would you consider T-DXd in the second line?
So, I mean, 2 plus is not HER2 positive, right? So if it's 2 plus ish positive, the answer is yes. If it's 2 plus ish negative, I would not actually use T-DXd right now in that patient.
Agreed. We'll go back before we move on to these cases. I'll kind of finish with the online cases. There's another case, 3 cases for colorectal cancer. The first one is a 65-year-old gentleman with hypertension, metastatic disease to the lung, to the liver, HER2 IC3 plus, and also has a KRAS G12C mutation. Status was frontline FOLFOX and FOLFIRI bevacizumab. Next step for this patient, T-DXd or KRAS-directed therapy? Eric, you want to tackle that one?
Yeah, that's a good one. That's a rare special case in this setting. I don't think we have the data to make a strong statement which one we would go. We in Europe don't have the KRAS inhibitors approved, so we would go rather for HER2 targeted therapy if they would be available, the KRAS targeted therapies. Intuitively, but that's just gut feelings. That's no science. I may go, if I have to choose for this patient, for HER2 targeted therapy in this patient. But if I would see a patient with second opinion where the referring physician would have said G12C, I would not counteract that also in this setting.
I agree. Data-free zone. Zev, do you agree? Or?
I mean, I think, you know, we do have the KRAS G12C inhibitors approved with EGFR in this country, right? So I think we have the advantage of having that. First of all, it's pretty rare because, as you heard from Eric, you know, they're almost mutually exclusive, these KRAS mutations and true HER2-positive colon cancer. So that's a pretty lucky fellow. I would probably, veer a little more towards the KRAS because I feel like that's pretty nice, durable data that's been demonstrated both with adagrasib, cetuximab, and with sotorasib, panitumumab. But, then I'd follow later with HER2 targeted therapy or, with T-DXd later.
Right. But yeah, definitely rare.
I also would not disagree with Dr. Right. Ben Cutson's recommendation if I saw the
the next one, Dr. Ellis, if you want to tackle this one. This is a 60-year-old female with metastatic colorectal cancer, HER2 IHC3 plus on initial biopsy, HER2 amplification on NGS. Treated with tucatinib pertuzumab, progression on the new tissue, HER2 IHC0, but NGS shows persistent HER2 amplification. So I guess how should one approach a case where there's persistent amplification and a ctDNA, but loss of expression in the tissue?
Yeah, this is a tough case, and certainly I would sort of use the actual copy number to probably inform that decision making a lot. Certainly, the copy number amplifications that are seen in gastroesophageal cancer can be significantly high due to all those chromosomal shifts that are seen. I would be probably a little bit hesitant to use sort of a HER2 targeted regimen in a HER2-low copy number, IHC0 situation, but I think the copy number would probably make a difference.
Great. So we'll probably go back to the cases here on the screen. So a 74-year-old gentleman with stage 3 colon cancer, treated with 12 cycles of FOLFOX, metastatic recurrence 14 months later, HER2 positive, IHC3 plus, RAS/RAF wild type. Would you skip FOLFIRI-BEV and treat with the Montanier regimen, or would you go to T-DXd? Eric?
Yeah, the label says that at least on the other side of the ocean that we should go for chemotherapy. But my fingers would itch, and I would rather scientifically outside of the label. I think the treatment with a two-targeted therapy would be very appealing to this patient.
Yeah, I agree. I think there's more and more data showing that, you know, the earlier you target the biology, the oncogenic driver, the better. So, Zev, I see you nodding. You agree?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I think that, you know, the FOLFIRI-BEV in second-line colon cancer, right, has a response rate of 10%. And so you have a pretty high response rate with both T-DXd and tucatinib and trastuzumab. So I agree with Eric. I would probably favor one of the anti-HER2 regimens over chemo in this patient.
Great. 62-year-old gentleman with metastatic CRC progressed on FOLFOX-BEV. Liver lesion, HER2 amplified, RAS/RAF wild type, choice between TDXD and trastuzumab tucatinib.
That's a choice we cannot really make in this type of patients, but in this type of patients, being RAS wild type, I think trastuzumab tucatinib could be an option. And then you still have, after that, as I mentioned in my last slide, if the patient doesn't respond, you can still do trastuzumab deruxtecan in this setting. After that, you don't have any data that if you start with trastuzumab deruxtecan, that if the patient is progressive, that tucatinib is still an option.
And I guess, can you speak a little bit to the, obviously, the mechanism of action? I mean, T-DXd is an ADC, so all you need, even if there's a resistant mutation, so to speak, all you need is to get to the tumor. Does that affect how you sequence these?
Yeah, that helps to choose in this situation, yes.
All right. The next case here, 72-year-old gentleman with metastatic colon cancer, HER2 mutant on NGS. HER2 mutations approach the same way as HER2 overexpression. What is the overall incidence of HER2 mutations in CRC? Is the likelihood high enough to justify repeat tissue biopsy versus liquid biopsy at progression? What about, again, those TKIs that we use in the lung? I think, Eric, in your presentation, you talked about the prevalence, the lower prevalence of HER2 mutations, but
1-2%,
right? Very low.
Yeah.
But would you rebiopsy? Would you repeat a biopsy given the low incidence?
No, I don't think I would do a repeat biopsy. You could do a liquid biopsy, mm-hmm. but I would not do a new tumor biopsy in these patients. We don't have so many data of HER2 targeted agents in colorectal cancer for HER2 mutations. They were not included in the tucatinib study. They were not included in the trastuzumab deruxtecan study. It could be active in this setting. Zongertinib, as was said earlier, in other cancers, in mutants, it seems to be there is appealing activity. I'm not aware of any published data of zongertinib in colorectal cancer with a mutation. I think there are some studies ongoing to look into that question, but that may be for the future an option
right.
Also.
Great. I think the next question, we've kind of touched on it a little bit. It looks like it's a metastatic colorectal cancer with brain mets, IHC3 plus. Would you do trastuzumab tucatinib versus TDXD? I know, Zev, you touched on it a little bit earlier.
Yeah, I think same rules apply as gastric here. You know, tucatinib has pretty good CNS penetration, right? So you're in that situation. So I would feel that would be my first choice there.
Agreed. The next one here, 62-year-old female, HER2 positive, colorectal cancer has a KRAS mutation on TDX progression after 12 months of TDXD. What is the impact of KRAS mutation on response to anti-HER2 therapy? What is the likelihood of response if changing therapy from TDXD to tucatinib trastuzumab? Again, that's kind of the question I had earlier related to the mechanism of action of TDXD. Does the mutation really matter? I don't know if maybe Dr. Ellis want to take that one.
Yeah, no, I definitely do think it matters. Again, we don't always see these co-occurring together, HER2 amplification and KRAS mutations, but because RAS signaling is one of the major downstream pathways of HER2, I think it is important to think about the mechanism of action of the drug you're giving in these settings. So TDXD has shown efficacy in these RAS mutant cases, so I would probably lean in that direction.
I mean, one of the key things, right, with HER2 is, as Eric presented, you don't want to use EGFR inhibitors, right? That's the big thing. You know those drugs don't work at all, even in the RAS wild-type patients with HER2. Those are resistance mechanisms there, so you want to stay away from those EGFR inhibitors if you know your patient's HER2 positive.
Great. Next case here, 54-year-old, metastatic colon cancer, widespread, with hepatic mets. HER2 positive, RAS/RAF wild type, frontline FOLFOX panitumumab, progression after 3 months, went to trastuzumab to tucatinib in the second line, had a partial response, but then eventually progression after 8 months with lots of hepatic disease burden, persistent IHC positive amplification, and newly acquired KRAS G12D, G12D mutation and an EGFR amplification. Would you go TDXD or target other pathways?
So there you go, right? HER2 patient progressed right away on FOLFOX panitumumab. That's actually not uncommon. The response to frontline EGFR is a very fast progression. And Raghav at MD Anderson has shown that about 10 years ago. And so I really think here, you know, this is a acquired mutation probably, which is not uncommon, happens. I think TDXD makes sense here if the patient is still HER2 positive. That would be my thought.
Dr. Ellis?
No, I totally agree. Zev is very prescient to have discussed that before this case. I completely agree with the thoughts with these, you know, acquired MAPK RAS alterations.
Okay. Another case of HER2 positive now with BRAF mutation, KRAS wild type. Progression after 18 months of TDXD. What is the next line of therapy? Continue anti-HER2 or add a BRAF inhibitor or stop the anti-HER2 therapy, change to kind of a BRAF targeted regimen?
The case for night.
Yeah, I would go for BRAF targeted therapy as far as I can understand the case. BRAF mutation, no, not yet any BRAF targeted therapy in this patient. It's a rare situation, I guess. I haven't seen any patients like that, but I would go for BRAF targeted therapy. The Breakwater, the Beacon data were quite clear.
Agreed.
And it's interesting that they mentioned fulfiristuximab and carafinib, which is actually, there's data on Saturday
Breakwater. With
that Breakwater combination that looks pretty good, admittedly, in the front line.
Correct.
But that's a prescient of that particular provider.
Correct. The next one is looks like a case of oligometastatic colorectal cancer to the liver, KRAS G12D mutant, HER2 IHC3+. As first line of therapy, any role for HER2 targeted therapy in addition to FOLFOX bed, kind of to convert? So any role for HER2 targeted therapy in the conversion setting here? I don't think...
That's what we hope for. That's one of the goals in the Mountaineer study, the Mountaineer 3 study that I showed the outline. In this study, we will look, of course, also at response rate and to see in the first line whether more patients with initially unresectable disease can be converted. But we don't have yet any data in this situation.
All right. Agreed. So maybe the last question here, I think we touched on this in the gastroesophageal cancers, kind of in the adjuvant setting, you know, any role for HER2 targeted therapy?
Too early, I would say.
All right. Well, we'll end on that note. Really, I would like to thank our expert faculty here for a wonderful job. And thank you guys for your attention, for joining us tonight. And then a happy birthday to Dr. Weinberg, who is celebrating his birthday today. Thank you.
Yes, sir.